In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about finding product market fit, organizing notes for maximum effect, growing from 100K of ARR to 1 million, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 348. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we made. So where this week, Mike?
Well, as I said on the last episode, I'd kind of finished up most of the tech stuff that I've been working on and started switching over to working on the website and marketing stuff, and currently targeting a public launch date of August 1st. So I'm kind of greasing the wheels of the marketing pipeline at the moment and doing everything that can possibly be done in the amount of time that I have.
Very nice. So it's about 3.5 weeks from now.
About 3.5 weeks from when this episode goes live.
Well, from when we record.
Yeah, no. Whatever. Something along those lines. Yeah,
it's a few weeks. So you must feel pretty good about it then. You must be pretty close to getting things out the door.
I do. Yeah. I mean, there's still a few things that need to be taken care of between now and then. So I've realized that, like, as I'm putting together the website itself to do some price tiering, that there are certain things that need to be in place that are not there yet, just so that I can, you know, charge different amounts based on different things. And maybe they'll be there and maybe they won't when it kind of goes live. But if I need to toggle stuff on the back end or do certain things or just give people stuff that they normally shouldn't have access to for the time being, then that's probably not a big deal. But yeah, it's, you know, I'm just finding those little edge cases here and there and, you know, reworking some things as necessary to make that happen. One big thing that I've kind of realized over the past couple of weeks is that I added a customer, I think of a week or two ago, and they had like this massive mailbox that went back for years and years and had like almost 750,000 emails in their mailbox. And the system generally held up pretty well. So I'm pretty pleased with how that stuff is going right now.
That's exciting. Yeah, it's nice to have some confidence going into a launch like this. You didn't just up and, you know, build a product and have no one use it, not know if they get value, not know all the bugs that you have, because you inevitably will until people use it. And no app survives first contact with a real customer, you know, without having bugs. And you've taken this kind of slow launch approach, you know, of trickling people in, getting your 20, 25 early customers in. That is it's obviously a more conservative way of doing it than the Silicon Valley pay $500,000 for some massive, you know, launch party. And I realize that's, I'm kind of being facetious, kind of straw man argument. A lot of people don't do that. But even, you know, if you have a lot of funding, you want to move really fast and you staff up and you build quickly, and then you just do this big splash launch and you're like, all right, product hunt, man, product hunt's going to do it. But then if you product hunt and you haven't already had 20, 30, 40 people touch this app, you just don't know what's going to happen. You know, as engineers, we know all the pitfalls and the ways things can go wrong. And so while this is a slower, more calculated and more conservative way of doing it, this is obviously the approach that we espouse on this show. It's that more careful, calculated, repeatable way to do it. And it's how, you know, I've launched a bunch of apps and, you know, how you're launching Bluetick here.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is that, like, I'm looking at the app now and I see places where clearly things will start to break or slow down just because of performance. And depending on what it is, sometimes I just look at it and say, I'm going to let this go, versus other times where, like, and this mainly has to do with, like, data sorting and paging and making sure that you're not returning too many things to the browser. And there's a few places where I've looked at it and just said, it can handle it. It's not great. It's not an awesome user experience, but it works. So for the time being, I can just kind of push it off and I'll fix it later, especially if customers start to run into it or it becomes a big deal. But, you know, it works. It's not going to fall over. And I'm not going to stop everything and put it on hold for like another month or two to fix those things. I may as well just push it out there.
You're always going to have some part of your app that feels that way. There's always a page or two that you're embarrassed about, that your concern's going to break, that's too slow for large accounts. That will never stop.
Well, I have a single page application, so if it's one page.
Oh, Mike. Listeners can't see me putting my head into my palm. All right. So for me, I'm actually working from Chicago this week. And with my son, we're at his cello camp. We used to go to Oregon for this, but now that we live in Minneapolis, it makes sense to come to Chicago. And to be honest, it brings back memories of, I was at the Oregon cello camp last year, and I was signing life-changing drip acquisition documents on my iPhone with my finger from inside the halls of a music building on a small college campus, you know, that no one's ever heard of in Central Oregon. And it was just this, I remember feeling overwhelmed and like I couldn't think straight. And we had we'd been talking about this for a year and doing negotiations for 6 months. And then I kept thinking to myself, shouldn't I be like calm, cool, and collected, like at my home office with my laptop? But no, I was like running in and out. Like I'd drop the kid off at a cello, basically a lesson or a group thing. And then I'd run outside and I'd read on my phone, oh my gosh, this piece fell through. And then I'd get a thing to sign to override this and to sign over. And it was exhilarating. It was also super stressful, but being here reminds me of that. And, you know, because it is the 1 year anniversary of the Drip acquisition was just a couple days ago.
And today now you can sit there without the dirty looks from the other parents.
I know, that's right. The parents were totally like, because you're supposed to, it's Suzuki, you know, method of teaching cello and strings. And so the parents are supposed to heavily participate. And I actually had to talk to a couple of the teachers and I said, look, I have something going on right now. Like I'm in the process. My company's being acquired and I need you to cut me some slack for a couple of days here. So that was fun. So let's kick off today's episode with a voicemail question. Note to the listeners, if you want to get your question to the top of the stack, send a voicemail because we don't get very many of them. And it's always cool to hear people's actual voice. It's just a better experience for everyone. It feels like a call-in show. So with that said, someone sent us a voicemail with a question for you, Mike, about Blue Tick.
Hey, Mike. And Rob, this is Andrew calling from Australia. Mike, got a question for you in relation to Blue Tick. You talk a lot about product market fit. Have you found with Blue Tick that you've had a general type of customer, or have you found already that Blue Tick has started to be suited for either a particular industry vertical, a particular customer type in terms of size of the company, or alternatively some other characteristic in terms of the groupings of your customers? Love the show and hope to hear you guys answer this question on air. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, so from the customers that I'm working with right now, they kind of fall into like a certain set of categories. And I'm not saying that these categories of people or the customer profile that I currently have for the people that I'm working with right now is the long-term ultimate customer base, I guess, of Blue Tick. It's just what I found so far and what seems to be successful. And they fall into a couple of different buckets. So the first one is startup founders who are trying to validate an idea. And most of them are trying to do cold outreach and get in front of customers or try and reach out to people that they think would be a good fit for their software. So they plug people into Blue Tick and it does essentially cold outbound outreach for those people and tries to get those conversations started. So that's one group. A second group is podcasters, to be honest. And people who are running podcasts and are trying to get sponsorships for their podcast are using Blue Tick to do that outreach to people they think would be a good fit and then start those conversations. And then they enter into like the individual emails back and forth to try and get them to buy into a sponsorship for those podcasts. And then a third category is small businesses who have an inbound lead funnel. And most of these are services-based businesses where somebody will fill out a form on their website and the customer is approaching them. And then they need to field that request and probably ask for more information or try and get them to the next step. But what they're finding is that a lot of people will fill out a form on their website or request information and then kind of go dark or go silent. So what Blue Tick does at that point is that because it's a warm contact, it will help bring them back to the table. And very similar to like Rob, you guys and Drip have this feature where you can send out a broadcast email and then several days later, you can reschedule that same email to go out with a different headline if the person doesn't open it. Blue Tick, because of the way that it works, after the first attempt, if it doesn't receive a response from the person, it will try again and again and again. And those additional steps in the email sequence tend to aggregate together and give you a much higher response rate than if you just sent that one email, waited, and if they didn't respond, then you kind of walked away from the conversation. So that's kind of the profile that I'm currently finding success with, and people are comparing other products to Blue Tick. There's a lot of different cold outbound tools out there or tools that will remind you, hey, you sent an email to this person and they didn't respond. But Blue Tick kind of aggregates those things together, not just their features, but also the fact that it's got like a mini CRM built into it and helps give you a bigger picture of the whole thing. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. I don't know if that completely answers the question, but there's a few different buckets that they fall into. And I haven't found one specifically that is better or substantially worse than the other.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I go back and forth on this. You know, I think like early on when, you know, I was as an entrepreneur, early on in your entrepreneurial journey, it's like I stuck to apps that really had a tight vertical niche. And I feel like that's a good way to keep things simple. you know where to find them. I like that approach. However, there are tools that in order to grow to a reasonable size, they're in such a competitive space that, you know, I guess it could be argued that, you know, you could say, all right, Bluetick is, you know, advanced follow-up and sales for podcasters. Like you could start out that way and then expand, land and expand is what it's called, and, you know, and then go horizontal. I think it's too early to decide that right now, but I don't think that'd be, podcasters may be too small of a niche, although it is growing.
It's interesting that you say that that's a small niche. I agree with you that it is, but they talk to each other a lot. So I get a lot of referral from that because somebody uses it, and that's, I think that's partly why I'm getting traction there is because they talk to each other and they're saying, how do I solve this problem of getting sponsors for my podcast? And then they say, hey, use this tool. It's really helpful.
And that's the thing is, you know, I say it's a small niche, but small is in quotes. Like if you were to build this to, let's say it tops out 30, 40, 50K a month, which I think there are enough podcasters to do that for sure. That's small compared to, you know, a multi-million dollar app or some Silicon Valley exit, but that's a heck of a lifestyle business if you want to keep it that way, you know? And if you own the niche and you're the name in doing it and you add things in that really help podcasters find sponsorships, and then you could even branch out into, well, conferences need sponsorships, right? That's the whole reason you built Bluetick originally, was to help with getting sponsorships from MicroConf. There are other things you could easily translate into. So we're definitely I'm getting ahead of you on this, or ahead of ourselves. And I don't think we need to make this decision or the distinction yet, but I do think it's an interesting conversation that you probably have or should have going in the back of your mind of, you know, do I need to go vertical because there's so much competition, or because you have to be different somehow, right? You don't just want to be one of many apps that's doing the same thing. You either want to go vertical with it and build the best one for that group of people, or you want to have a feature or two that really make you stand out where they say, well, how are you different than, you know, the five other apps that do this? And you can say, well, it's this and that, and this is the approach we take, and it's the lightweight CRM or, you know, whatever it is that you've built in that's different, that you at least have a talking point and aren't just a commodity. So thanks for the question. I like that one. I appreciate it. Our next question is from Aaron Cordova, and he's asking about notebook organization. And he says, how do you organize your notes? I've recently started note-taking with an iPad Pro and a pencil. Do you have a page per day? Do you organize by topics? Yeah. So I used to use my notebooks both for, you know, longer term notes and thinking and things I was thinking through, and I used it for to-dos. And then I tried like so many to-do apps over the years, and I finally switched to Trello, and I can't go back now because Trello keeps it all in the cloud. I have a record that never goes away. I can never lose it. I can access it from all my devices. I really like to-dos being in an app somewhere, and Trello is finally the one that broke me of that. So now my notes are really just in, you know, a black, like a Moleskine notebook. And I do not do a page a day because I don't write in my notebook every day. I use Evernote for some work things. I use Trello for to-do lists. And I use my notebook when I am on an airplane, when I'm deep thinking, when I'm trying to hash through a problem, because paper and pen just, I think so much better with that than sitting in front of a computer because there's no distraction, right? So if I were to flip through my notebook, I definitely date my pages and I put a topic at the top. And if I'm going to be thinking through one problem or taking action notes from a book that I'm listening to, or trying to think of what else I've written in my notebook recently, I tend to put things in there I want to say for a long time. So if I know that it's just super scratch brainstormy stuff, or it's like a grocery list or something that I know I'm not going to care about in a month, then I don't put it in my notebook. My notebooks, I keep them pretty much forever. I mean, I have notebooks going back 10 years, and I do flip through them, and I have some fascinating kind of insights that I, when I look back and think, man, that your view of the world was so different back then, you know, or maybe the world was genuinely so different, just the founder community and the entrepreneurial community and my aspirations for it. But all that to say, so I don't organize by topics because I just flip to the next page, I put a date, and then I go, you know, I flip through. Now, this means that I don't particularly have a great like organizational system. So when I remember, oh, you know, I remember Derek and I talked about this and I noted that down, I have to think in my head, I bet that was about 6 months ago. And then I flip through the notebook and I find the page. So while it's not the most efficient way to get there, what I really like about it is the serendipity. Typically, when I'm flipping through that notebook, I'm reviewing a bunch, like six, 8 months worth of thoughts that I have forgotten about. And actually the act of looking through them reminds me, I often will remind me of like, oh yeah, there was this feature we were totally going to build, or, oh yeah, we never implemented that one thing, or I never got back to that person, or we need to architect, you know, it's just like all these stuff that isn't urgent and doesn't keep coming back on the radar, but that was a really good idea, you know, 4 or 5 months ago. So for me, my notebook is more of like a time capsule, and it's, you know, for deep thinking and thought process. And that is actually why I don't like Evernote for it, because Evernote, I know it's great if you want to search, you know, or any of these note-taking apps, OneNote or anything. Great if you want to search and you know what you're looking for. But if you just want to kick back, you know, with a cold beer in one hand and a notebook in the other, and you just want to flip through and kind of read things almost like a dead tree or paperback book, that's the experience that I relish. And that's what I love about my notebooks. That was more information than you probably ever wanted to hear about it. And it may be a unique use case. So I'm curious to hear what your take is on this.
Yeah. So I've tried Evernote and Trello. I mean, I still have my Evernote account. I just don't ever use it. And there's things in there that I don't go back and find or look at. The problem I found with both Evernote and Trello is that if I'm using it for any sort of to-do list or task management or anything like that, I end up with so many things in there that it just really falls apart. And it's too general purpose. So what I tend to do is it's broken down based on what it is that I'm doing. So usually what I'll do is I'll either start with index cards for like a set of daily tasks that I need to do and get through, and I can just like mark them off as I'm getting through them. And occasionally what will happen is that something will stay on an index card for too long and it'll end up on like the next day's index card or the next week's. And if things end up there for too long, what I do is I essentially end up promoting it to some other place. Sometimes I'll have a notebook where I will write down short-term notes about something that I'm working on, whether it's really complicated or has a lot of things that I need to keep track of, and I'll write them down on paper. But at some point, like, you mark off a bunch of stuff and then you end up with like 5 to 10 pages worth of stuff, but half of the pages are all crossed off. It doesn't really make sense anymore and you can't move them around. So at that point, I start moving things over into tools. So for anything that is bug or feature related, it tends to end up in FogBugs. Most of my general purpose tasks, or if it's a marketing task or a related to a specific project, it usually ends up in my Teamwork account. If it's some sort of thing that needs to go on a shared list that I use like for home stuff, I use something called SimpleNote. Or no, it's not SimpleNote, it's AnyList. And I have a paid account that I share with my wife because it's a family account. So like we'll put our grocery list and things like that on it. And it works really, really well for that. Outside of that, I will also use Google Docs for taking long form notes about a particular problem that I'm working on where I don't want to write it down if it's not just a really quick thing or if I need to think about a lot of stuff, I'll put it in Google Docs. And then for mental brain dumps at like the end of each day or the end of each week, I have a journaling app that I have a subscription to called Penzu. It's Penzu. That system works really well for me because each of those tools tends to be focused on a particular type of problem that it's solving. And it has the tools and the features and all the things that go with it that allow me to keep things organized within that context. Once I start crossing the borders between different contexts, like the tools tend to fall apart. Like you can use FogBugs for marketing tasks, but you don't really necessarily want to be paying for like a FogBugs account to give some, you know, like contractor or somebody who is not going to touch any of your development stuff, giving them a FogBugs account is kind of pointless. So it's easier to put that stuff into Teamwork. I have a tendency to feel like this type of problem, it's going to be different for everybody. And like, that's why there's so many different, you know, to-do list apps and note-taking apps, because everybody works differently and you ultimately settle on something that works for you. And the other 99 apps that you tried didn't ultimately work out. So I feel like this is a very context sensitive problem in terms of the type of person you are.
Yep. And the process you use and how you want to handle it. I agree. So thanks for the question, Aaron. I hope that was helpful. Our next couple of questions are from John. And he says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. I've been listening to your podcast for about a year, and I get bummed when Stitcher doesn't have your podcast ready to listen to every Tuesday before my ride to work. I have a couple questions. First is, what are your thoughts on pay what you want pricing? I've created software called Breakneck Install, which is a downloadable application that helps developers quickly create an installer for their application. There are giants in the market and my product can't compete with them. And I don't feel like I could charge near what they do, which is more than $500 per license. And I thought of trying the pay what you want model. One of the benefits I see is not having to worry about licensing issues, such as maintaining and creating backend infrastructure to deal with licensing. My fear is that I try this and then decide to go a traditional pricing model, which may make future customers unhappy. Do you have any thoughts on this?"
I think for a product like this where you're trying to build an installer, it almost feels to me like what you're going to run into is the market is going to be split between these people who are just starting out and they're trying to build a product, but they don't have any money. So you're not going to get them to donate money to your cause. It's not going to be a viable source of income. If it's something that you want to do because you have the money laying around and you want to put your effort into something like this, then that's fine. But I wouldn't look at pay-as-you-go pricing or pay what you want pricing for something like that to really be able to make a dent in the in like your bottom line and be able to let you go full time on it. I just don't think that it's going to happen. There's also a lot of open source alternatives out there that would make something like this difficult. You're absolutely right. When it comes to installers, most of them tend to be very expensive. And what you'll find is that the people who don't have the money will go for like the free and open source versions. And even if you give them a paid option that is a pay as you want, or pay whatever you want, it seems to me like you're probably not going to get very much money from that. And they're not necessarily going to be willing to, pay software maintenance and things like that. And you're going to spend a lot more time fixing bugs and addressing individual issues than you are trying to build a product where if you were just selling it to smaller businesses that had revenue and the capabilities to pay $500 to $1,000 per license, you'd be able to make a business out of it.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about this. I've never done it, so it's hard. I can't speak from experience. I can only speak from the experience of entrepreneurs who I've seen done it and who I've talked to. And it can work, but you need a really large install base, or you need a lot of people downloading. So you can't just say, I have a few hundred downloads a month and expect that you're going to be able to do pay as you go and make any kind of money from it. And the problem is if you do pay as you go and someone pays you $10, how much support do you now owe them? Like, you know, if they start asking for feature requests, if there are bugs that they discover, if they're demanding, if stuff goes sideways, like it becomes a challenge. So I can see a lot of problems with this. And my gut is that it's not going to work unless you are getting, I don't know what the number is, but it's thousands and thousands of downloads per month, because a bunch of people are going to pay you nothing. And then a few are going to pay you, you know, a small amount. But, you know, when podcasters try this, when other small downloadable, you know, WordPress plugins or whatever try it, they don't tend to get a lot of money. I don't know that I agree with your fear that if you were to have it be free for now, or not free, but pay as you go for now, that you can't undo that later without making future customers unhappy. I think what I would say is I'd either call it a beta or an early access, or put some moniker on it. And I would say it's pay as you go while it's in early access. Even if you've already released it and it's not in early access anymore, that's what I would do, so that if you decide that you don't want to go pay as you go anymore, that it just doesn't work out financially, you can always undo that. And it's a pretty easy thing. I've seen apps go from free to paid before. And as long as you don't, you know, if you grandfather people who already have it, I don't really know what complaint future potential customers could have other than, oh, I guess I should have downloaded it last month instead of waiting to now. And you could even, you know, there was a time where I tripled the pricing of .NET Invoice from $100 to $300. And a couple people emailed me and said, hey, I was in the process of thinking about buying it. Can I still get it for, you know, $95 or $98 or whatever it was? And I gave it to him. It was like two or three people. One I later regretted. He actually turned out to be like the worst customer. It was like the first toxic customer that we had. But that's kind of beside the point. So I don't know. I mean, it's easy enough to try. I see your point. I think if you have something that can't compete in the marketplace, like going freemium or pay as you go is often not the right answer. The right answer is make something that can compete in the marketplace, you know, have a differentiator, or just set a cheaper price. I mean, you know, if this thing really does do a good chunk of what developers need, they can only get it for $500 elsewhere, then, you know, what about charging $99 or $199? You don't necessarily want to be the low price leader, but is there a space in the market? You think about, you know, Infusionsoft, Eloqua, all these really expensive marketing automations, and Drip came in with at the beginning, a lighter weight product that was easier to use and less expensive. So I do think that, you know, there's an angle that could be had there as well.
Yeah, I think the lower price point is definitely an angle that you can go at, because there are certainly ways that you could charge a couple hundred dollars for an installer. And I do like your idea about letting people know, hey, this is pay as you go for the time being, and then, you know, making the point that it is something that you can undo later and move to some other one. Just be upfront and clear to people, like, hey, this is the pricing for now, and it's going to change. We just don't know what it is yet.
Our next question is about growing from 100K of ARR to 1 million. And this is from Pavel Braminski. He says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. I've been listening to the podcast for years. I really respect what you've done and that you're sharing all this knowledge with the rest of us. I found your podcast immensely helpful in launching my own SaaS app, which is called Snap Projections. How do you think about growing a self-funded SaaS past 100K ARR? So that's, you know, what, about 8 or 9K a month? What do you specifically pay attention to in terms of marketing, sales, operations, hiring? Any specific tips on growing in a vertical niche versus horizontal? What would you do differently right now?" It says more of a question for Rob, but it would be interesting to hear Mike's take as well. Anything specific to watch out for? And then his background on them is that they have two people on board, more than 120 clients/customers, relatively low churn, and they're operating in a niche of financial services applicable to Canada only.
I'll be honest, like, I don't know how qualified I am to actually answer this question. So Rob, why don't you throw some things out there? I mean, maybe there's something I can think of and piggyback on it, but.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a really broad question, but I appreciate it. It's almost like, what are the things to watch out for? Because they've already, you know, had a decent amount of success, obviously, to get to even that 8, 9, or 10K mark. And it's like, what's the difference to get to seven figures, or what has to change between then and now? What my experience with this is that it's going to depend on how big the market is that you are in, right? So I'll bring up Drip because that's the most recent thing I've done, but we were in a position where we were in such a large space that we didn't have to change anything in terms of our market, right? So we didn't have to go from vertical to horizontal or do any of that, because there were just enough people. There were enough people who wanted it that we needed to do it. We needed to execute on marketing and hiring, in essence, you know, keeping developers going to build features. But really, the product has always been, once we have product market fit, has always been really solid. So I think that's the first question to ask, is if you really are in a niche of financial services in Canada only, it's like, is the market even big enough to get you to a million? Or are you going to have to either go into another vertical or go more horizontal and serve a lot of vertical niches, or just not even be vertical at all? So that's one thing to think about. I think you can get, you know, you can definitely get to seven figures with a very small number of employees or contractors, somewhere between 5 and 10. So I don't think that, I think one thing to watch out for is hiring too quickly or trying to hire ahead of revenue because you want to get there faster. It's kind of a lesson that I learned, that it doesn't necessarily, especially hiring developers, doesn't necessarily make that revenue move faster. If you're already at that 10K point, I always would try to look at, what is my bottleneck here? Why are we not growing faster? Is it because our product needs more features, or is it because we're not marketing or selling enough? And then my next hire would be either a developer, or it would be, you know, a marketer or a salesperson, or we'd start doing demos or whatever. When we were in that 10 to 20K MRR range, maybe we just hit 25. That was when I realized that not having someone who could talk to people on the phone and essentially do customer success / sales, that was a limiting factor for us. And that's when we brought Anna on, and that was a game changer for us. That was a bottleneck for us in that, you know, that 20 to 30K range. You may be there, but then again, you may be that salesperson and that's not your limiting factor. And it's more of your market's too small and your development team's moving too slow or whatever, and they need more help. So that's the thing I think that you need to think about at every point, is whether you're at 10K or 50K, what is your limiting factor? What's going to double your growth next month, or add 50% of your growth to next month? Because you want growth. The bigger you get, you have to accelerate growth, right? You want to accelerate growth. So when you're at 10K, growing at 1K a month is actually like, it's kind of a victory. The time you hit 20, 30K, you want to start growing at 5K a month. So you need to think differently about, how am I going to, you know, 5X growth between those two points? And that often means, you know, either going wider, building features faster, or dumping more money into marketing or getting into paid ads, finding a new channel, because that can be a big piece of it, is you may just need more people in the top of the funnel, right? That may be a thing, or you may need to close more people that are in the funnel. And it's kind of looking, that's where I use all those rules of thumb that we've talked about in the past. You know, if you're already converting 40 to 60% of your trials to paid and you're asking for credit card up front, then that's fine. Then I would push that aside for now, and I wouldn't try to improve my onboarding anymore. And I would say, how can we just get more people to the top of this funnel? You know, but if your churn is 10% per month, well, then how are we going to cut churn by making the product better and by retaining more people? And it's looking at each of these things and just bouncing from one to the next, and you improve one, and then you put more people in top of the funnel, and then you realize, oh, now this other thing's broken, and you just hop from thing to thing. So that's kind of a brain dump of how I've thought about it, but I hope that gives you some things to chew on.
I think everything that you just said there kind of boils down to recognizing where the bottlenecks are going to be, and whether one thing that comes to mind is, like, you know, you'd mentioned something about limiting yourself to just Canada, for example, because that's where the company is based right now, and those are the people that they're targeting. But does the customer profile need to change? Like, are you targeting one type of customer and you need to move to a different type of customer, let's say small financial planning companies versus individual financial planners? Like, does your customer profile need to change in order to be able to get more revenue per customer in a way that's going to help the business grow, or are you going to max out? And again, that's just a limiting factor, not necessarily through like geographical border, but like the customer base that you currently have and that you're going after. But that all boils down to the same thing. Like, is there that limiting factor that you're going to need to overcome, whether it's that, or whether, as you said, like the bottlenecks in the marketing funnel, customer acquisition, all that stuff, it's finding those bottlenecks.
So thanks for the question, Pavel, and apologies it took us so long to answer it. He actually sent that to us last October. Our last question of the day comes from Matt Sensenbaugh, and he says, "Hey, Rob and Mike, I'm launching a SaaS app on April 1st. Sorry, Matt, that was a couple months ago, with two customers who have already signed on. My question boils down to, what legal documents do I need at launch? Terms of service, privacy policy, sales agreement, etc. Do you guys have any recommendations for getting the required documents in a cost-effective manner? Finally, does doing a sole proprietor affect this legal question at all?" I will start off by prefacing that neither Mike and I are lawyers, nor do we play them on TV. So our advice is based on experience. It should not be considered legal advice. And of course, you should consult with an attorney to get real legal advice. I have a quick answer to this one. I can say, when we launched Drip and when I redid Hittail and when I've done my other apps, terms of service and privacy policy, the only two things that I really have. And I use, as a free plug for these guys, they used to advertise on This Week in Startups, but it's Snap Terms. snapterms.com, and I think it was like $600 for privacy policy and terms. Those are not going to be the best, right? If you were to pay for a lawyer to do it from scratch, it might be $1,000 or $2,000, but they will work with you more to get tighter, buttoned up language. But if you're launching with two customers, it's just how much time and money do you want to spend on this?
Yeah, there's a ton of privacy policy in terms of service generator tools out there. And there's even some that are licensed under Creative Commons, and you can use any one of those. And, you know, I think our general guidance, not necessarily, as Rob said, legal or financial advice on this particular thing, is like, what we've seen people do is find something that seems reasonable for the time being. And then once you get to a point where you can afford it and you have something to protect, then you go the route of having something custom built and custom designed for your situation, because none of the tools out there that, you know, either generate these things for you, or even the ones that you find on a website like SnapTerms and you download something that is reasonably customized for you, they're not going to encompass every single scenario. And every lawyer has, my lawyer has done this before, like, he will look at legal agreements and he will take things from different legal agreements that he's seen based on how they've been used in the past. So if one of his customers got screwed over by a particular piece of legal jargon, he will sometimes take that and put it into his legal agreements to make sure that his customers and clients don't get, you know, the short end of the stick when it comes to interpreting the documents that he's put together. And based on how experienced your attorney is, like, they're going to have a wider wealth of knowledge the longer they've been in business and the more agreements that they've seen. And they're going to be able to use those to craft the one for you. And maybe you get two or three different lawyers from different firms involved. You can. It seems like it would be overkill, but it's always an option. And I'm sure that, you know, like, larger businesses tend to have legal teams so that they can get that kind of experience and breadth and put together something that covers them from every possible angle.
Yeah. And the part about it's a sole proprietorship, how does that impact it? I mean, it just means that you have more exposure and more liability. I don't know that it's risk tolerance, right? Like we always say, you just have to figure out if you're concerned about there being liability on your shoulders, or if you know, in these early days, if you feel like you could get sued for something, because the way to remove liability or to push it off is to form an LLC or an S corp, and then, you know, have really tight terms of service and privacy policy and all that stuff, kind of airtight, as they say. So that's the way to ultimately get rid of it all. It costs a lot of money, and it's again, for me, in my experience, it's not something that I spend a lot of time or money thinking about in the early days of an app, because there is less exposure at the time, but you have to evaluate it for yourself.
an interesting hack for this to find out how much exposure you have is to go to an insurance company and ask them for a quote for liability insurance and find out how much that quote is, and then use that to decide whether or not you need to go out and get something crafted from an attorney to help cover you. And that seems to me like a pretty good way to get an independent gauge of how risky what it is that you're doing is. So for example, like back when I was doing enterprise level consulting, we would be given admin access at the domain level on somebody's network. And some of these companies were like, you know, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, NASDAQ, those types of companies. And our insurance rates were outrageous. They were like, I don't know, $500 to $1,000 a month for insurance. And it was only like two or three of us. So that was absurd. But like my wife's got insurance for her business and it's only like, I forget, like $100 a month or something like that. It's ridiculously low. So like depending on what you're doing and how much risk and exposure you have, the insurance company will charge you more. And just getting a price quote from them would be a good way to get an independent verification of how much risk there is without you having to sit down and do a ton of work on it. I mean, you're going to have to provide them with paperwork and documentation, and they'll have an auditor review it, but you could use that to help out.
Yep. And if you're going to do that and get a quote, I would recommend a company that I've worked with before. They just made the process really easy, and it's foundershield.com. And they themselves are a startup that's kind of just an insurance broker, but they kind of operate like, I'm guessing they have some funding because they operate like you would want a startup to operate rather than some stodgy old business insurance company.
So Matt, hope that helps. And I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up for the day. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupstherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Our theme music is an excerpt for We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.